Here's a Japanese sandman sneaking on with a mule. Just an old second-hand man.
Hello and welcome to The Good Friends of Jackson Elias, the regular podcast about Call of Cthulhu,
horror films,
and horror gaming in general.
I'm Paul Fricker.
I'm Scott Dorwood.
And I'm Matt Sanderson.
And this episode, we're looking at some more Call of Cthulhu deities, Shubmel, Yggdrasil, and Bugsash.
We're continuing our occasional series of discussions of the deities of the Cthulhu mythos with a look at a few gods created by Brian Lumley. While we had this episode planned for some time, we recently learnt of Lumley's death, which makes this discussion timely in a kind of sad way.
Let's begin with Shubmel.
Is that how you pronounce it then?
I don't know.
I've always kind of pronounced it Shubmel, but who the fuck knows?
However you want.
This is something I was thinking of, because I found myself thinking, actually, I kind of pronounce it with an L in there. Can I always pronounce it like Shubmel?
Ah.
But considering it's so infrequently looked at by me, I'm hardly surprised I fuck up the pronunciation.
But also, these things aren't meant to be pronounced consistently, so the fact that we pronounce it three different ways seems entirely appropriate.
If any of these great old ones want to get in touch and tell us we're saying their names wrong, we'll give it another go in a future show.
Actually, if any of these great old ones want to get in touch, please don't. Don't. We don't want to hear from you. No.
This one turning up would probably destroy the property values in my area quite easily.
He can reach you anywhere on the planet. So, technically, Shubmel is first mentioned in the 1969 story, Cement Surroundings. This became a chapter of Lumley's novel, The Burrowers Beneath. Shubmel is a purported deity of the Chthonians, a race of intelligent subterranean entities that burrow through the densest rock by melting it, and they look nothing like the worms on Dune. Nothing at all. Nothing at all like that. But they kind of do, right?
Yeah, they do. And also, I always thought the name Chthonian was a bit on the nose for an entity that lives underground. I don't know. It's like having an entity that lives in the water and calling it wet.
I'd never actually could have thought of these like sandworms in Dune. I put that more in the territory of the dolls or bowls, depending on what spelling you want to go for it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Mm.
The Chthonians always reminded me of trilobites that had been stretched out. So rather than being curled up,
They'd
been elongated. And then you had all the many tentacles at the front of them, rather than it being the massive mouth. They seem two very different stylistically looking things.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I do kind of confuse dolls and Chthonians, really, because they're both kind of like big worms.
Yeah, but Chthonians have got tentacles. In terms of them looking like trilobites, I mean, trilobites look very much like woodlice, just very large woodlice. I don't know what the woodlice are like around your area, Matt, but mine don't tend to have tentacles.
No, I realised that as I'd said it.
Are you thinking of ammonites?
Yes, that's the one. That had an ite in there.
Right, okay.
My knowledge of fossils is not as good as it used to be. That said, the leader of the Chthonians in the book is an unpronounceable name beginning with C, who is another giant specimen of the species, who describes himself as a child of the more pronounceable Ubo Sathler. And that does just look like a cat has walked across his keyboard. That really does look completely unpronounceable.
Either that or it could be Welsh.
With additional apostrophes.
The Chthonians are first described in a carving encountered by the story's heroes. And might I further tell you what you saw on those unknown tunnel walls, that those oddly dimensioned designs depicted living creatures of sorts, like elongated octopuses or squids, but without recognizable heads or eyes, tentacled worms, but of a gigantic size.
Eventually, however, they encounter one in the flesh. It was octopoid, this dweller in the earth, flowing tentacles and a pulpy, grey-black, elongated sack of a body, rubbery, exuding a vilely stinking, whitish slime, eyeless, headless too. Indeed, I could see no distinguishing features at all, other than the reaching, groping tentacles. Or was there, yes, a lump in the upper body of the thing, a container of sorts for the brain or ganglia, or whichever diseased organ governed this horror's loathsome life?
As well as being huge and nearly impossible to kill, barring their weaknesses to water, spoilers, the Chthonians possess psychic powers, including the ability to read human minds and exert telepathic control over them. They can also create earthquakes. Nice side benefit, I guess. And some can manipulate the weather.
I mean, it kind of seemed like both these things are... I mean, they weren't designed with messing about with humans. It feels to me just a side effect of their mental powers that they can communicate with humans. And the causing earthquakes, well, it's just because they're massive things moving around underground, isn't it? It's like, I mean, it is a power that they have in the game, but anything that big moving around under the ground, well, it probably is going to shake things around a bit.
Well, except there does seem to be a telekinetic aspect as well, because it seems to reflect somehow the way they manipulate the weather too. So they definitely do seem to have psychic powers. Mm. And I mean, this ability to telepathically communicate with and control humans, if I remember correctly, also allows them to identify any single person anywhere on the planet and just home in on them.
Yeah, yeah.
Unable to escape, I await the thing. I'm trapped by the same hypnotic power that claimed the others at Garn. What are the monstrous memories? How I awoke to see my friends and companions sucked dry of their life's blood by wormy, vampirish things from the cesspools of time. Gods of alien dimensions, I was hypnotized then by the same terrible force, unable to move to the aid of my friends or even save myself. Miraculously, with the passing of the moon behind some wisps of cloud, the hypnotic effect was broken. Then, screaming and sobbing, utterly broken, temporarily out of my mind, I fled, hearing behind me the droning, demoniac chanting of Shudmel and his hordes. That's why they have weather control, you see, so they can get rid of these wisps of cloud that get in the way of their psychic powers.
It also seems kind of weird that they have such immense powers like this, but they're disrupted by... or what, moonlight in this case. But hey, I'm not judging. Shudmel, or Shudimel, or whatever we're going to call him, and his children were imprisoned for centuries in the lost city of Dead Gahan, known only in legend, and which has in the past been spoken of on a par with Atlantis, Mu, and Rillie. The city is possibly located in present-day Mali, which I think is... where it's listed as being in the Call of Cthulhu rules, so I could be wrong there, or Ethiopia, which some fans of the story seem to think. The entities were imprisoned there by star stones, these round stones with elder signs emblazoned upon them, which at some point just stopped working. There was some speculation in the story about whether this was because they simply wore out over time, like the battery running down, or whether perhaps these sinister ancient forces nicked them.
It was my hope, a hunch you might call it, that Gahan had been real. And with the deciphering of the fragments, I found it within my power to prove, one way or another, Gahan's elder existence. I have been in some strange places, Paul, and have listened to even stranger stories. I once lived with an African tribe whose people declared that they knew the secrets of the lost city, and their storytellers told me of a land where the sun never shines, where Shudmel, hiding deep in the honeycombed ground, plots the dissemination of evil and madness throughout the world, and plans the resurrection of other, even worse, abominations.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing in the story, that it's not just the fact that you've got this monstrous, mind-controlling, earthquake-making, weather-controlling worm god crawling around under the ground, but his plan ultimately is to release Cthulhu and all the other great old ones and bring about the end of days.
Hmm.
I just like the fact he had to go to Africa, to a place, a land where the sun never shines, when he could have just come to Northamptonshire. This would have saved him a hell of a long travel.
The sun is shining right now, Matt, as I look out the well, kind of weakly glowing, at least. There are shadows I can see outside.
They're bigger over here.
Well, shadows imply the sun is shining, right? Yeah, so what do we make of this? He's a big wormy dude who lives in the middle of the earth and is the king of the Chthonians. He can communicate with people telepathically. I mean, I'm not really sure why he'd want to do that, but, you know, to help, you know, he gets the overlanders to do his bidding, I guess.
Cell phone reception underground is pretty bad, so they're going to need some alternative to talk with folks on the surface.
Well, it does cost him 5 points for every 10 miles, 5 magic points.
But I assume he's got a fuck ton of those.
That sounds like quite an old scheme that he's under, to be honest. I think you'd get a lot better deal nowadays.
It doesn't appear much in published Call of Cthulhu works from what I could find. There's At Your Door, but that's kind of a discount store variation called Shadukar, which maybe was renamed for licensing. I don't know, but you could have easily just called it Shudamel and it would have been exactly the same thing of the role it fulfills in the story, because it's another big, mighty Chthonian. He's mentioned in Day of the Beast, but doesn't directly appear there. But yeah, it's, as far as I can tell, unless someone can correct me otherwise, I can't find any stories that feature him.
I mean, he's such a massive adversary to sort of feature directly. I mean, so are many of the Mythos gods, right?
Yeah.
We can perhaps see ways that we could use his influence. I mean, and also in the Malleus Monstrorum, there's some suggestions about powers that he has. So obviously, you know, telepathic control, we've already mentioned. He can also create hell holes, basically like massive sinkholes, but with tentacles coming out of them about half a mile across. So, you know, having one of those. I mean, I think these things like Shudmel will be really great, but could remain totally off screen through the whole of an adventure and just be underground, you know, influencing people and creating geological effects, you know, hell holes, like these big sinkholes or earthquakes and so on. I mean, it's a massively powerful thing. So it's listed as having 100 hit points, 8 points of armor and 5 points of regeneration. So, you know, can I punch it? I mean, no, really, is the answer.
I mean, you can punch it. Should you punch it? No, but you can. Well, assume you can get underground to do so.
Lots of tentacles and crushing attacks. Okay, this was a cool little fact, I thought. Should it be reduced to 1 hit point, it dissolves and kind of bubbles and melts its way through the ground, wherever it is, like kind of acid, like alien blood. And you know, it travels down to the center of the earth where it reforms in 1,000 years. So you could have a story kind of set in like Dark Ages, say 1025, 999 years ago, where the thing is somehow killed. But then we know it's going to turn up, well, this year.
There are other entities like Shudmel out there that are these giant Chthonians. Because let's face it, he's not really a classic Lovecraftian deity in that he just does seem to be a large example of his species, which I guess Cthulhu sort of is as well.
I mean, Dagon certainly is, right?
Yeah, that's true. But what that suggests, perhaps, is that he's not the only one out there, and there's certainly another very large one out there in the boroughs beneath. So perhaps there are other ones like that out there that have been destroyed at some stage that have done this thing where they've dissolved and trickled down through the earth. And I guess you could have fun with a scenario, perhaps, where some has seeped into what is now the shaft of a mine, a seam of something that has been mined out, and you're now pulling out these bits of coal or whatever that have been infused with bits of the liquid essence of this slowly reincorporating giant Chthonian, and maybe some parts of it are just doing strange things to the coal, or maybe you're just getting small parts of it coming to life within the seam. I reckon you could do some really weird shit with that.
Story-wise, bits that leapt out of me, particularly just from reading the entry in Malleus Monstrorum, it talks about the tribe of worm men that supposedly are either the remains of or descendants of the peoples that built Gahan, the city that supposedly this Shudmel was trapped underneath. And when I read that line, I was thinking, surely that's just another line for crawling ones.
Mm.
being that they are the big worm monsters. And again, there's that that's that implication that they are undead sorcerers have then survived beyond death.
Yeah.
And thinking, okay, there's maybe a connection between worm men or crawling ones to drag in with Chthonians or to drag in with Shudmel. They're more accessible rather than big honking underground worm. Because otherwise you're kind of almost restricted to it being, unless you have it pop up above ground and make an earthquake wherever it lands, you're almost restricted to underground settings like either Kinyan, Yoth, Nakai, etc. So there's, again, already a very niche type of scenario that you'd have that would feature him, which makes me think it's almost a lost trick to see why he didn't turn up in Coldfire Within, which goes deep underground.
Hmm.
Because he would have been a great pulp villain.
But also, if you do have these worm men who worship them, you could perhaps have a religious schism where some of them see the dolls as the ultimate form of the worms, and some of them see Shudmel and his children as the ultimate form, and you know, there's a big fight going on between the two factions as to whose worm god is the best worm god.
My worm's bigger than yours. Well, that did make me think of another practical use for him, inspired by, of all things, a line from The Phantom Menace. There's always a bigger fish. Just imagine if you did have a doll problem erupt on Earth.
Oh.
Summon Shudmel. Up he comes, swallows the doll whole, and goes back down into his hole again.
Is Shudmel bigger than a doll?
I was going to say, I'm not sure he is he?
Just by the fiction, the narrative, it seemed like he was horrendously big.
I was frantically searching through stats right now.
We need to resolve this, Paul. We need to resolve this now. I mean, this is serious stuff.
Well, okay, I'm going to say Shudmel first. Shudmel size, 600. Huge, right? 600.
Mm-hmm.
Doll, average size, 2,700. That's like four Shudmels with change.
Maybe he bit off more than he could chew.
Three times as many hit points. Yeah, Shudmel is big. A doll, much bigger. But, you know, there's more than just the size of the worm.
It's what you do with it that counts.
But dolls aren't too bright. Intelligence 35. That's not great, is it?
Which is weird, considering they've got psychic power.
Well, dolls don't have psychic powers, do they?
Oh, I thought you meant that Chthonians had low.
No.
Yeah, so Chthonians, or at least Shudmel, could certainly outsmart them. And I guess he's got access to magic as well, which might make a bit of a difference. If he can't take on a doll in a fair fight, he could probably summon something that could.
Yeah, whereas Chthonians are pretty bright. I mean, Chthonians have got an intelligence stat of 90, average 90. So they're much cleverer than humans.
That's not saying much.
Well, okay, that's true. But what are they doing down there? They're that clever. They're just worming around under the ground. I mean, they probably say the same thing about us, right? What are they doing up there? They're so clever. Why are they just walking around on the surface of the planet? Why aren't they down here where all good stuff is? I don't know. What's down there? Maybe this is a whole hollow earth thing as well. You know, hollow earth. Why is the earth hollow? Why is the earth hollow? There's your answer, Shudmel. They dig it up.
But the answer to what are they doing down there in the burrows beneath is, for most of it, or most of human history, they're just sitting around under Gahan seething because they've been trapped down there.
I mean, that's pretty much what I do every evening.
Sit underneath a dead city and seethe?
Well, I just do it on my living room sofa.
Oh, the same thing.
You know, just watching the news and seething, or, you know, whatever.
What is Buckingham but a dead city anyway?
Exactly. Exactly.
One of my lecturers did describe it as the land of the newlywed and the nearly dead.
I'm probably on the lower age of the average sort of demographic here.
Fucking hell.
I think there's a lot of people that are quite... It's not a retired community, but there's quite a few retired people, I'd say. Yeah, I mean, there's young kids and there's old people. The bit in the middle doesn't seem to be around very much. Except me, obviously. Now, how do we say this one? Yib Stul. Because there's no I in Stul, the second part.
Yeah.
It's T-S-T-L-L. Yib Stul?
It could be that the leading T is silent. Yeah, I'd say Yib Stul, maybe.
I imagine so. But also it looks a bit like still. It looks like they should. I think we read it as still because it looks like the word still, but...
Still? No, that doesn't really work.
Well, this guy of dubious pronunciation exists outside of time and space and can be contacted through dreams. He's first mentioned in passing in the 1969 story Cement Surroundings. Again, where have we heard this one before? This is merely part of a typical litany of mythos names, however. Without warning, like a man suddenly gone into a hypnotic trance, he began muttering of Shudmel and Cthulhu, Yog-Sothoth and Yibstil, alien gods defying description and pronunciation.
There is a more substantial mention in 1971's Rising with Circe. I do not know where my muscles found the strength to carry my tottering and mazed body out of that house. Sanity did not drive me, I admit that, for I was quite insane. I wanted to stand beneath the stabbing lightning and scream at those awful rain-blurred stars. I wanted to bound, to float in my madness through eldritch depths of unhallowed black blood. I wanted to cling to the writhing breasts of Yibsil. Insane, insane, I tell you. I gibbered and moaned, staggering through the thunder-crazed streets until, with a roar and a crash, sanity invoking lightning smashed me down.
I like this sanity invoking lightning. Like lightning invoked his sanity. It brought him back to his senses, perhaps.
Shock treatment, yeah.
The titular substance known as the Black, from The Caller of the Black, also from 1971, can be called down upon the victim as a curse in a manner very much borrowed from M.R. James's Casting the Runes. From the space which is not space, into any time when the words are spoken, can the holder of knowledge summon the black blood of Yibstil, that which liveth apart from him and eateth souls, that which smothers and is called Drowner. Only in water can one escape the drowning. That which is in water drowneth not.
Talk about walking contradiction.
Well, it's this thing about water. He's very vulnerable to water, Yibstil.
Yeah, I wonder how much all of this thing with water, with the Chthonians and here with Yibstil, comes from Derleth's interpretation of Cthulhu. I guess it's there to some extent in Lovecraft, with water being a prison that holds Cthulhu in place and blocks his powers a bit. But in Derleth, it's much more this elemental association of the elemental power of water containing him. Mm. And I think perhaps Lumley's picked up on that and run with it.
It is not until 1977's The Horror at Oakdene, however, that Lumley explores Yibstil more thoroughly, giving us a slightly more detailed description. And there was me thinking writhing breasts was a big enough description already. Oh, well.
Oh, no, guess better.
Then there was the German Baron Ernst Kant, who, before his hideous and inexplicable death in a Westphalian bedlam, had believed his every insane action controlled by a creature he called Yibstil, described as a being huge and black with writhing breasts and an anus within its forehead, a black-blooded thing whose brains feed upon its own wastes. Shithead eat shit and, in this case, don't die.
Sounds very William S. Burroughs.
It does rather, yeah.
I was more thinking Jeffrey Combs in From Beyond.
Oh, yeah.
The pineal gland opening in his forehead.
Oh, no, Spare Ass Annie, one of Burroughs' characters, had an anus in the middle of her forehead too, so.
Yeah.
Maybe related to Yibstil. That would seem quite credible to me.
There is something quite Lovecraftian about Spare Ass Annie.
Hmm.
In the story, Martin Spellman, a trainee nurse at the Oakdene Sanitarium, is drawn into a patient's plans to, for some fucking reason, contact Yibstil. The patient, Lana, has been making his own imperfect translation of the Cathat Aquadingen, which contains much lore about Yibstil. And there is a fairly large section of this translation that is absolutely pertinent to this discussion. 1. To call the black. This method involves a wafer of flour and water composition printed with the 6 sathlata in the original symbols, handed to the victim with the summoning chant. This will not produce Yibtzil, but his black blood, which has the property of being able to live apart from him, called from a universe so alien that it is known only to Yibtzil and Yog-Sothoth, conterminous with all spaces and times. The victim is taken aback when the black blood settles like a mantle about him and smothers him. Then the juice of Yibtzil returns with the soul of the victim to the body of the drowner in his own continuum. Yum yum.
This is like a Nigella recipe. 2. To see Yibtzil in dreams. And the 6th sathlata may be used, that one might scry in dreams the form of the drowner, Yibtzil, who walks in all times and spaces. It must, however, be observed that the chant should be used sparingly, once only, before each sleep wherein the scrying is to be done, lest the seer impart into that on which he gazes a perception of the gate of his mind. And that in using this gate to enter from outside, and in returning thither through this same gate, Yibtzil may burn out the mind and gate and all in his coming and going. For the agony is great and death certain. Nor in such a visitation would his actions in the sphere be controlled.
3. To call Yibtzil. This method again involves the use of the 6th sathlata, called out 3 times by 13 adepts in unison at midnight of any first day. Note, unless at least 7 of the callers are adepts, and unless, on the night before the midnight of a calling, they first seal their souls with the Naktith barrier, they may well suffer hideous reversals and penalties. 4. Buy a copy of any M.R. James collected ghost stories.
I'm still trying to work out, though, the kind of person who reads all that and thinks, yeah, groovy, let's summon him. This sounds like fun. It can't go wrong. It can't possibly go wrong. Does Saturday work for you? Yeah, let's try Saturday.
I mean, it's no more weird than a lot of stuff that people do. So, I mean, I don't find that at least incredible.
Yeah, it was either that or Morris dancing.
Well, there you go.
Spellman then finds himself encountering Yibtzil in dreams, even before the summoning itself is complete. His dream spirit felt the pull of the thing in the scabrous clearing. Yibtzil, huge and potent, turning inexorably, almost stupidly about his own axis, with his cloak billowing monstrously as the night gaunts beneath its folds flapped and clung in blind horror to the black and writhing multiple breasts. In case it's not clear from that little bit, the cloak is very much part of his own anatomy as well. It's like this cowl that's built into him.
And later, when the noisome activity about him ceased, he fearfully looked up and found himself at the feet of the colossal thing in the green cloak. Again, those awful eyes, those red eyes that were not fixed in their places, the eyes that moved quickly, independently, sliding with vile viscosity over the whole rotten surface of Yibtzil's pulpy, glistening head.
He's not really a looker, is he?
But you mentioned that cloak. That's in the Malleus Monstrorum. That's listed as armour. If he's got the cloak open, he is more vulnerable. But still not very vulnerable.
Can you punch him? Can you punch him in one of those writhing breasts, or will they writhe out of the way?
Well, 50 hit points, pretty good. 12 armor, 8 of which is cloak, 4 of which is skin. So if you can get through the cloak, but trouble is, two things. There's night gaunts, which is posited that possibly Ibstil gives birth to night gaunts, or at least nurtures them. And there's its black blood, which it can do three things with. It can use the blood as a weapon and kind of like reach out and suffocate and strangle people with it. It can use it as a blessing. So, yeah, you can get a little bit of it and ingest it, which I don't recommend, but it gives you communication with Ibstil. And also, it can put forth a bit of its blood to become a sentient living being, either on its own, like it could take the form of a dog, or actually a dog would be pretty cool, like the black dog.
Would that be a bloodhound?
Boom, boom. I was thinking like the black dog, you know, like the...
Black Shuck.
Yeah. But or it can, all the blood can, you know, you can take it in and it can sort of basically possess somebody. So again, that's sort of ways that this entity could come into a game. Somebody could be in communication with it by having accepted its blessing, or somebody could be possessed by it, literally by its blood. And then if they're cut, they bleed like black rather than red.
The things that stood out to me, apart from A, I absolutely love the picture that the description paints of having to go up to one of the teats of this thing and suck on its blood. But you have to fight your way through the night gaunts that are also trying to do exactly the same thing. So it's a case of, no, give me that breast. No, give me. And you say fight off against a faceless night gaunt trying to get a mouthful of this stuff. Although where exactly they're sucking, because the night gaunts have no mouths, I'm a bit confused at. But
I like that you thought of that.
Yeah, you see, I think anatomy. But one of the things that I think they latched onto, without pun intended, is that last line of the third part of the long quote that we took in turns earlier, where it says, they may well suffer hideous reversals and penalties. Because this is expanded upon in the Malus Monstorum, and I think also in the Encyclopedia Cthuliana, where I read the entry for this as well. And it struck me as very much being got echoes of the House of Renunciation from Unknown Armies, that someone that asks a question that Ibstil, because this omniscient thing, you can go to it and ask questions for like a massive clue dispenser, that you can go to it and ask me, what is the answer to this massive secret of life, universe and everything? And if the god doesn't like the question that you've asked, it can spin this reversal upon you, which is effectively the examples that it makes are things like turn a crazy man insane or make a virtuous man sinful. And it just struck me as being very much, oh yeah, this is what happens when someone who's passed through the House of Renunciation comes out very much the kind of mirror image of themselves in terms of personality on the other side. I thought that could be something you could play around with. Not so much having the god make an appearance, but very much dealing with the aftermath of someone that had gone there and been fundamentally completely done a 180 on themselves. Or you have a group that are trying to play on that supposed downside, in inverted commas, by sending someone in that's very flawed to begin with to hopefully make them a better person at the other end.
Oh, like a sort of spiritual quest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you can extract and ingest the blood separately, as that section seems to imply, then I wonder whether you might have people who actually harvest the blood and try using it for that effect. As that description said, that isn't necessarily the effect it has, so perhaps it goes horribly wrong, as it tends to do in horror stories. But it seems like the way that psychedelic drugs are sometimes used as treatments for addiction, or for other psychiatric disorders, that people take them because they have pronounced transformative effects upon the human mind, sometimes very beneficial ones. And in this case, perhaps someone is trying to do the same thing, experimenting with the blood of Ibstil as a way of breaking some kind of pathological behavior in that reversal way you were talking about, Matt, but is unaware of the other effects of it and the connection that it makes with the deity and the negative transformative effects. Yeah, it could be really interesting if it starts off being positive if you're slowly perhaps slipping it to someone who is in the thralls of, say, heroin addiction or something like that, trying to cure them of it, and then at the end of it they're cured of that, but then something else really sinister seems to be happening within them.
There's also an entry in the Malleus Monstrorum called The Touch of Wisdom. The physical touch of Yggdrasil's tentacles cause others to change. The change may be physical, mental, or other, as deemed by the keeper, and may be beneficial or harmful. And we've got a D10 chart to roll on. So it can affect characteristic, adding or subtracting like 2D10 or more. It can grant 3D10 Cthulhu Mythos, which is a lot.
Yeah.
You can be healed of injuries. You can gain secret knowledge, you know, of the keeper's determination, or you can have dissolution. This is like the old Rollmaster criticals. Dissolution, black ichor erupts from the skin, melting flesh and internal organs, killing the person in one round.
Ow.
Okay, so don't roll a 10, basically. But, you know, that's kind of fun. So this entity, Yggdrasil, and the whole milk aspect sort of reminds me of Shub-Niggurath. Because there's a lot of scenarios and uses of the milk of Shub-Niggurath. But that's usually a corruptive influence, whereas this seems like it could be corruptive, but also it can be a route to knowledge. You know, it still is kind of a font of knowledge, and seekers of wisdom come to it to learn, which I think is a kind of sets it apart, this way that you can get to it and learn like arcane knowledge, or can either just affect your stats, or the keeper can give you some good intel should you make your way there and commune with this thing.
Which is pretty much exactly how it's used in the Spawn of Azathoth, where it appears.
Mm.
That it is essentially a big clue dispenser that helps progress the campaign on to the next part when they have this journey through the jungles of Kled to go and find this thing and ask it a question.
I just love the idea of being given the direction. Go up to that monster and suck the clues out of it.
Slurp.
But I also like the fact that it lives outside time and space, and you're encountering it through dreams.
Mm.
It's like that's not even the real version of it you're encountering. It's like a representation in dreams. And so even this very weird, transformative version of it that you're encountering is almost like a projection or a reflection of the real thing. You're never encountering the real thing itself. Maybe you could do something with someone determined to encounter the real thing itself outside time and space, which again seems like the kind of thing that's not going to go well.
And this thing seems to be, I mean, it's listed as dwelling in Earth's dreamlands, so it would be a good reason for like a dream quest for a party to go on a dream quest into the dreamlands, because it's a good goal to go and find this thing. You know, if this is the only source of that secret knowledge that they need, or they find this is one source of it, then that would be a good chapter in a campaign, I think.
Yeah, we say exactly what happens.
Hmm.
That's something you don't necessarily see that much in Call of Cthulhu, and I do like that aspect of it, that when you encounter the deities of the mythos, they're usually these malevolent threats that are presenting some kind of existential danger towards mankind, or things that have got to be combated or so on. But here, yes, you've got something that is incredibly dangerous and alien, but you have this incentive to kind of deal with it on its own terms, to go to it as a seeker after knowledge. That's something that, I mean, you do get every now and then in Call of Cthulhu, but probably not enough, because I think that's a much more interesting way of dealing with these mythos deities than, oh, big gribbly fight.
Yeah, and encountering it is more of an experience than it is like a conversation, I think, which makes it makes it more sense that you would, to me, that you would get information from it. Because, you know, why would Cthulhu talk to you, you know?
And makes them more alien.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, more of a, almost like kind of a psychedelic experience, as you referred to earlier.
Yeah, ayahuasca with breasts. Writhing breasts.
Well, I, for one, need to go and have a suck on a teat to get some sustenance. So in that few minutes, let's have a word from one of our sponsors.
There is rampant disease in the Hooverville.
Someone get the doc!
The Apocalypse Players present Bleak Prospect by Scott Dorwood.
Sense of dizziness comes over me again.
My hand! My hand!
Is there anyone you'd like to speak to?
His hand has crumbled in yours. Every time he moves, another part of him sheds away and crumbles.
In your dream, Nancy?
They didn't have any faces.
Part of a season of nameless horrors from the Apocalypse Players.
Here we go.
Allons-y!
What a wonderful evening!
I don't want to hear the song again.
Well, there's blood splatter, right?
Come to Paris, they said. It'll be romantic, they said.
It wasn't a great idea.
I am sweating.
I'm gorgeous.
Flaking skin.
The payment is blood.
I love this guy.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you like obscure books of hidden knowledge? I know I do. The Blasphemous Tome is a Call of Cthulhu fanzine produced by the good friends of Jackson Elias. Everyone who backs us gets immediate access to a host of sanity blasting issues of the tome. Join us at patreon.com/goodfriendsofjacksonelias.
And now we're back, satiated from all that sucking. Let's go on to another monster, or another god.
Wipe your mouth first, Matt.
Well, next we're looking at Bugsash, or Bugshash, another cool name. First mentioned in Lumley's story, Rising with Cersei, but only in passing. Watch, damn you! Watch while I scribble it down. You damn great crimson eye, always watching me. Who would have thought that the lips of Bugsash could suck like that? Watch, you redness, you, and look out for the Scarlet Feaster.
Words to live by.
The deity is further developed in The Kiss of Bugsash, another tale about would-be sorcerers getting silly with curses and summonings. Here, Lumley assigns the name to a hitherto nameless entity borrowed from David Sutton's story, Demoniacal. Bugsash the Terrible, a demon whom Ibon of Muthulan himself had written of as being one of the darkest beings of the netherworld, whose trail is that of a monstrous snail, who hails from the blackest pits of the most remote spheres. Cousin to Yibstil. Hey, we know that guy. Bugsash, too, is a drowner. His lips do suck and lick. His kiss is the slimy kiss of the hideous death. He walks the very dead to his command, and encases in the horror of his essence, even the worm-ravaged lich hastens to his bidding. So much purple, it made Lovecraft proud.
And like Yibstil, Bugsash is described in Mythos tomes as a drowner. Bugsash is unbearable. His lips suck. He knows not defeat, but brings down his victim at the last. Aye, even though he follows that victim unto death and beyond to achieve his purpose. And there was a riddle known to my forefathers. What evil wakes that should lie dead, swathed in horror, toe to head?
Nah, what dreams may eternal lie is a much better line there.
Although it seems unwise to do so, Bugsash can be physically summoned. This happens in the story. At this, the abominable chittering grew louder still. It surrounded the circle completely now. For the first time, the two conscious men clearly saw that which the single, tiny remaining flame held at bay, creeping up on all sides to the very line of the chalked circle the thing came, a glistening, shuddering wall of jelly-like ooze in which many mouths gaped and just as many eyes monstrously ogled. This was Bugsash, the drowner, the black one, the filler of space. Indeed, the bulk of this being did seem to fill the entire study, all bar the blessed sanctuary of the circle.
The eyes were beyond words, but worse still were those mouths, sucking and whistling with thickly viscous lips. The mouths glistened and slobbered, and from out of those gluttonous orifices poured the lunatic chitterings of alien song. The song of Bugsash, as his substance towered up and leaned inwards to form a slimy ceiling over their very heads.
And this description really echoes the descriptions of Shoggoth from The Mountains of Madness, in my opinion. This dark gelatinous mass covered with shifting eyes and mouths. That sounds a lot like a Shoggoth.
It's a lot like a Shoggoth, but on the other side of that coin, if you're comparing it to a coin minted in some weird mythos currency, Shoggoth one side and a hell of a lot of Daeloth on the other.
Mm.
How this is presented again, more around the surrounding work that's been done in the game setting, this acts almost like a carbon copy of Daeloth. It has to be summoned in complete darkness, check.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give it an offering, otherwise it will take you with it, check. Admittedly, it's more that Daeloth requires a drop of blood, whereas this requires a victim to go with it. It has to be summoned within a pentacle. This one's a pentacle of power, pentacle of planes for Daeloth, check. There's a hell of a lot of similarities between these two beings.
Hmm. Daeloth doesn't give you a kiss, though, does he?
Well, not on the first aid.
Yeah.
Because Bug Sash has literally got an attack called Kiss.
So, instead of can you punch it, should you be asking can you kiss it?
The Kiss of Bug Sash. It's a manoeuvre. Well, aren't they always? Envelops a target and bestows a kiss, enveloping and suffocating the victim until dead. There you go, that's not good.
Hmm.
He's only got 90% kiss, though. You know.
Even great old ones have off days.
Attacks per round, he's got 3 attacks per round, it's 52 hit points, 66 damage bonus. You know, you're not going to stand up against the old buggy for long, really. Immune to mundane weapons, including bullets. So, no, you can't punch it because it's immune. Mm-hmm. It's just like punching a jelly.
We've all been there.
You're better off just getting your phone torch out because it doesn't like light.
Mm-hmm. But one of the more interesting aspects of it from the story seems to be the relationship that it has with the dead. Is this reflected at all in the write-up in Malleus?
Oh, yes. It has a combination of what they call lumped in together as flesh puppets, which I think are a wonderful little tool the GM can use here, where it can almost transfer a part of its consciousness into someone that after it gets its proverbial foot in the door, or in this case, words in their ear, it kind of worms its way into their brain, gradually eroding them down until it takes them over entirely. That they've got, well, I think mechanically they have about 5 power left, so they become almost echoes of who they previously were. But they get some good bonuses. They get like extra con, and I think they get another stat bonus as well. But they become puppets for this god, so it can act in our universe to do whatever it wants to do, to further some plot that's going on. Or one of the things that's postulated in Malleus is that it's trying to find a way, a bit like Glaki trying to escape his crystal prison, that this thing is trying to escape its own reality, that it maybe the reality that it's trapped in is, as it says, a trap or a prison, and it's trying to find a way to break out. And that's why it has these puppets that it uses. Where it has these living flesh puppets, it can also create dead ones. So you have got the living ones that can talk and do things, and then you've got good old traditional zombies that get up and do the work as well. Because sometimes you just need a big old zombie brute to do the work.
Do those zombies still have any echoes of the person they used to be in them?
I think it's described in the text of Malleus to say, use the stats and templates for zombies in the core book, and I don't think the ones in the core book do. So it's almost like the memories and such is more the living flesh puppet, that retains the memory of the person that was devoured.
Because the puppet definitely does. I mean, there's a good sort of contrast between the puppets and the zombies, because the zombies, like you say, Matt, are just kind of zombies. The puppets, as you said, their power is reduced to 5, so they don't really have any power. But their intelligence isn't affected. And if they were able to cast spells, they can still use their spells.
Mm.
Like you said, again, their physical stats, strength and con, are both significantly boosted. So these puppets are pretty powerful NPCs for the Keeper to use.
But it occurs to me that if I were going to use Bugshash in a scenario, I'd probably change the way it works slightly so that if it were animating the dead, that it did actually bring back a bit of who they were with them, because that would be a really powerful motivation for wanting to call upon his power. Resurrection, in general, is always an incredible motivator in a scenario in a story. Being able to bring back the dead for whatever reason, maybe because it's a loved one you miss, or maybe because they knew something that you really want to learn for yourself. You just really need to talk to them about something. And the idea of being able to bring back this sort of undead echo of them that's still got a bit of their consciousness in them so that you could commune with them somehow would be an incredible motivator. And of course, yes, from everything else in the story, that's got to go horribly wrong for you as well. But it wouldn't be fun if it didn't.
Well, thinking you've given reasons to summon it, your good old traditional, hey, I want my wife or husband or lover back. I was thinking this could also just make a great trap for cultists, that if you find someone out there that is, let's say, susceptible to the lure of the mythos and esoteric knowledge, you give them this spell as a kind of, well, this is someone that we really think would be better out of the way so they don't cause problems down the line. So here, call up this thing that can give you vast, unlimited knowledge, a bit like Gib Sill. So have this thing, call it, but just take out the line that says, oh, you need to have a victim ready to offer them, and then it takes them instead. So it snatches away potential would-be cultists and removes problems before they become one.
I wonder whether, with all the brains that it hooks into, all the human consciousnesses that it hooks into, whether it absorbs that information into itself as well. Because that, again, is, if you're looking at the mythos in a very neutral way, that's not necessarily, I mean, it's still a horrific thing, but it's something that might be potentially attractive in that it could, A, present some form of life after death that you live on within the gestalt entity within this god, or B, it almost becomes like a living archive of human consciousness that maybe once humanity falls to the return of the great old ones or climate change, whichever gets us first, then there will still be some echo of us living on within this hideous gelatinous mass, still perhaps conversing with all these different consciousnesses trapped within it.
Running on that what's left behind kind of thread. One of the things about these flesh puppets we hadn't mentioned before is they can be cast aside if they're not useful anymore. So if they are either deemed not useful for any way, normally they've taken too much damage and it will take too long for them to become usable, the god relinquishes its power over them. So you could potentially have someone, maybe a former PC or an NPC that they know, that could be rehabilitated, even though they've only just got 5 POW left. You need to do a hell of a lot of either rolling ones on your luck checks or doing opposed POW rolls to try and get it back up to something a bit more than an animal state. But it could be interesting to see what happens with trying to bring someone back from the brink of that kind of possession.
Yeah, well, particularly if they were actually dead, perhaps they've been reanimated by this, and you're trying to rehabilitate them from, they're still perhaps somewhat decayed and desiccated, and they're not quite all there because their brain's slightly rotted, but yes, you're still trying to get them into contact with what it was that was human within them, which, on reflection, may not be a kindness.
You're getting very much to warm bodies territory now.
Yeah, I think there could be some scenario scope for doing a kind of a Bugshash Ibstil kind of mashup, you know, having both entities involved, particularly as Ibstil is kind of restricted to the Dreamlands. Well, not totally restricted, but, you know, resides there and can be summoned. But seems to me there's a couple of interesting deities. I feel like I'd get more use from these than I would from Shudmail, but don't know.
Of all those three, Bug was the one that really kind of spoke to me and really actually started firing off bits of imagination, of inspiration for me. But I think what I'd want to do is go back to this David Sutton story, this Demoniacal, to see exactly how much Lumley took from that story. Because there seems to be a running theme through these three. They're very much inspired by other works. like Shudmel, you've got very much is, oh, it's a bigger one of its own creation. You could cough and say that's like Dagon and Deep Ones or Cthulhu and Starspawn. You've got Yggdrasil is very much just an M.R. James lawsuit waiting to happen. And Bugsash is an entity that you could say is created by someone else entirely that he just gave a name to. So I'd want to see what that original core kernel of inspiration and idea was that he drew upon.
Oh, well, let us know when you find out.
I've been looking to see where it's been published, and I found there's a couple of chapter books with it in, but I don't think it appears much in wide print beyond that.
Hmm.
Surely chapbooks, not chapter books.
Chapbook, yeah. I think there's one that's Tales of the Mythos, or Tales of the Cthulhu Mythos, like Volume 3 or Cthulhu 3. It's a very small, limited-run thing that I can find online. I definitely want to get hold of a copy, because this does sound like something I could definitely get my teeth into.
And, I mean, even despite some of them perhaps being a bit derivative, one thing I do like about all three, well, no, not all three of these, but one thing I'd like about Yggdrasil and Bugsash is the fact that Lumley does, in his descriptions of them, manage to make them fairly repellent and disgusting. Mm. He does something that Lovecraft himself, I don't think, ever really consciously did, which is lean into a sort of uncomfortable, almost sexuality about them, with the sucking at the writhing breasts and the intrusive mouths and so on, that there is something very physical, there is something almost carnal about the interactions with these deities that does add that additional layer of discomfort to the whole thing.
Thank you. You're listening to the Good Friends of Jackson Elias. You can find show notes for this episode at blasphemoustomes.com, where you'll also find all our social media presences. We have t-shirts and other merchandising available at our Redbubble store. If you're enjoying this show, please consider backing us at patreon.com/goodfriendsofjacksonelias. Thank you for listening.
If you are enjoying the Good Friends of Jackson Elias, we would love it if you'd let people know. Whether this means leaving a review somewhere where people might find a review, or just mentioning it should the topic come up or adjacent topics come up on social media. Or alternatively, you could make a quest into the Dreamlands and tell the hideous entities that you find there all about us. Just don't tell them where we live.
Okay, well, we're working our way through our big list of mythos deities, but if you have any suggestions of ones that you want us to talk about, then we can bump them up the list. Do let us know. I think that wraps it up for today, so until next time, it's a goodbye from me.
Cheerio from me.
And a farewell from me.
Hello? BlasphemousTomes.com.
And now I'm going to go off and have a suck on that teat.
Milky, milky.